eyes, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Thank you all. Be seated, please. Good morning and welcome to the Idaho Supreme Court sitting at the College of Southern Idaho in Twin Falls today, November 8, 2025. 2024, I guess I'm getting ahead of myself. We appreciate the college and their hospitality and welcome for us here today to conduct court. First matter before us is Marler versus Gearhart, number 51274. Dan Gearhart appeals, represented by Eric B. Nielsen. The respondent, Kristen A. Marler, is represented by Stephen L. Adams. Counsel, do either of you have any preliminary matters for us before argument today?
I got it.
Very well, Mr. Nielsen, you may proceed.
May it please the court and opposing counsel. I wanted to start my argument today by just talking about the environment that we're kind of existing in as we have this conversation. I started practicing family law right around the time that the new rules for family law were being implemented, which gave us informal custody trials, which gave us mandatory disclosures, which gave us judicial settlement conferences, and started relaxing and increasing the discretion that judges have in the courtroom related to how they operate with trials, how they operate with the rules of evidence, how they operate with all of the types of things that they need to make decisions on. We really started to see an increase in discretion and a decrease in gotcha moments, moments in which it makes it difficult for litigants, difficult for pro se people, and difficult for disabled people, or difficult for people to have access to the court. During that time, I've seen a family law courtroom become a room entirely of discretion, entirety of equity, and one in which magistrate courts get to make equitable decisions. And with every new iteration of that change, and of those, we've attempted to improve the litigants' experience in the courtroom. My primary argument today, and I think the question that this court needs to answer, has to do with the time frame in which a child support order is entered and a new petition for child custody or for child support is filed. There's that time frame between, again, the order that's been entered and the new petition that's been filed. Does a magistrate court have any jurisdiction, any discretion whatsoever over that number until that petition's been filed? Because the way we're looking at it today is as if between the time that an order for child support's been entered and the time that the petition's been filed, that's going in a locked box. We can't touch it. We can't satisfy it. We can't credit it. We can't debate it. We can't do anything to it other than wait until a petition's been filed. What I guess I'm advocating for and what I'm talking about here and where it's a source of the authority to which Judge Hammerly made her decision comes straight from Levin and Reed, which talks about how in a family court, in a magistrate court, the magistrate judge has the discretion to modify or to award any child support order. 32706 in the Idaho Child Support Guidelines talks about how magistrate courts can depart from making those orders to make sure that they're just and to make sure that they're appropriate. My argument today is that magistrate courts do have discretion to touch that number. And it's not an electric fence. And it's not something that they have to avoid specifically through satisfaction and specifically through credits and abatements. And not every single thing that happens to that number do we call a modification. If every single thing that happens to that number is called a modification, then our magistrate courts are stripped of important abilities to make equitable and just decisions. And that comes out in many examples, but in this case in particular, where we have somebody who clearly Idaho law favors the idea that someone who's disabled would have their child support credited against any Social Security disability dependency benefit through which their ex-spouse is receiving. In this case,
But is that true given the language of the child support guidelines? I mean, if you look at G5 specifically, it reads to me like it's envisioning I'm going to use the word credit. I don't think that's the right concept, but taking into account Social Security payments, that where they get taken into account is in setting the support order, not crediting the back end of the obligation. So, I hear what you're saying, but I mean, in the face of G5, I just struggle a little bit with the concept that this is a credit situation and not. I mean, it looks like the framework that we have seems to envision Social Security payments being taken into account in setting the award.
Well, and I certainly think that that's best practice. You know, I certainly think that that is what the guidelines have envisioned, and I'm not disagreeing with that. Okay. And I think that if you read back in my motion or in the motion for summary judgment and some of that stuff, this was always been a question of we know that he should have filed a modification. That's true. That's best practice. I also believe that in the course of the entirety of a child support order, that there are situations and times in which the judge, the magistrate court, can exercise their discretion to abate or satisfy and again, it sounds like I'm just making up a workaround, but I'm not. And here's a couple examples that I think that happen all the time in courtrooms.
And before you get to the examples, Mr. Nielsen, my struggle with your argument is Idaho Code Section 32-709 specifically says the provisions of any decree respecting support may be modified only as to installments occurring subsequent to the motion for modification. And so I think you make a powerful policy argument for why the legislature should create an exception similar to what Oregon has. But our legislature hasn't done it. And so I'm struggling with how we can override the provisions of a statute that, while magistrate judges have a lot of discretion in this instance, the legislature said, no, you don't. You need to have a motion for modification.
And I understand the argument. I can see it from all sides. My argument is that not every single thing that we do at that number is a modification, and that you could satisfy it, that it could be satisfied.
And that's where, when I look at the decree, the decree orders Mr. Gerhart to pay the sum of $639.81 per month. And so when he doesn't do that, how does the magistrate court, because that's, even if it's not modifying the number, it's modifying a provision of the decree to say, okay, it says he needs to pay it, but in light of what's happened here with the benefits, he doesn't have to pay it. It strikes me that's still a modification of the decree.
And I think that's what the court needs to decide. My feeling on this is there's a lot of ways to approach this. If I paid the child support then, if I paid Dan's child support, does she still get it twice? You know, and if Social Security or unemployment comes in and pays child support, does she get it again?
And what happens, so let's say that this is a case where I understand that your client had private disability coverage this whole time. And
right.
So I get that. But a lot of people don't have that.
Mm-hmm.
And so they get, there's an award of child support that they've got to pay. But because of disability, they can't pay it. They file for Social Security. There's a lag. And so by the time that they finally get approved for it, they're 18 months behind in child support, and then they get a lump sum, and their child gets a lump sum. What happens in those cases? Does, in your experience as a practitioner, do the judges usually allow a credit for those lump sum payments?
I think that, yes. I think that when in my experience, I have both won and lost this issue in front of magistrate courts. And it's because of that exercise of discretion, where I have brought not just issues related to a satisfaction related to this, but let's say health insurance was baked into the child support amount, and let's say mom got onto Medicaid instead, and that child support and that health insurance premium wasn't actually getting paid, and so that number was incorrect. I've seen courts satisfy that. If ICCP drops out of a child support number that's been included, these are when the tax code changed and they changed the child tax credit from $2,000 to $3,000 and had nothing to do with anything the magistrate court did or anything that the parties did, I've gotten credits, abatements, satisfactions, all of those sort of things. Magistrate courts are satisfying these because they are unjust results. That's why it's really difficult as a family law practitioner to see this result. And it's because I see it in a way that, no, there are situations, many situations, where this is happening all the time, where it makes no sense for a magistrate court to just say, yeah, you know, ICCP didn't cover that anymore. He was supposed to probably pay another $500 a month in child support or for that daycare. That's lost now. You're out of luck. Sorry. Magistrate courts correct these small situations and minor issues related to the child support number day in, day out in the courtroom. And that's where I'm struggling with this case, is because I don't think the discretion over the child support number just is zapped and is dried up, because I've seen it happen time and time again where, especially since we're filling the child support number with payments that come from third parties who are not associated with this. Because best practice, if the result is that every single thing that happens to this number is a modification, best practice for me is to never include a third party anything in my child support amounts, because then therefore I can go back into court and I can modify those, or I could go back and say, hey, this wasn't fair.
Let's talk about the situation as it applies to the actual facts of this case. I can understand some of the inequities that you're passionately talking about here today, and I think it's easy to point to the law and say, well, the law is not perfect. But isn't the bigger problem here just the long delay, the fact that your client waited 2 years to assert his rights? And doesn't that kind of tip the equitable scales pretty far to have someone sit on their rights for that long and then come back and say, I want a credit for money that's already been spent? It doesn't seem like a good way to run a system.
And to your point, it's a question if the magistrate has any discretion at all, right? Because if no discretion exists there, then the question doesn't matter. If discretion exists, and you're saying that Judge Hammerly abused her discretion by looking at the factual situation and saying, too late, you shouldn't have done that.
I'm not talking about her discretion and her decision. I'm just talking about, if we weigh the equities from a policy standpoint, oh, it's inequitable to do it this way, so we need to change the policy to do it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the reason the policy is the way it is because it mitigates against these late claims for child support adjustments.
Yeah,
that's what I'm getting at.
And again, this is probably a policy argument for our most vulnerable in our state. You know, for the disabled population, where, especially where this was happening during COVID, if you look at the dates this was happening, is like April, May, June of 2020. There, I mean, I think you get what I'm going with that.
Yeah, I understand your point. It just seems like the current system, as imperfect as it is, it encourages people to timely seek adjustments.
Right, absolutely.
But more so than that, I mean, I think another competing policy interest here is not having people who are obligated to pay support at all just say, I'm not going to do it. I've decided, you know, you've qualified for this or you no longer need that. And so I'm just going to stop paying and I'm not going to file a motion for modification. You can take me to court and I'll ask for credit.
Right. Well, and I think in this particular situation, it is, and I believe this to be his genuine belief, that is what was going on. And of course, there's demand letters that were coming from opposing counsel. But even then, the belief was that, I'm getting dependency benefits now. I don't own child support. And that went in for a long time until he came and met with me and we filed a motion immediately, knowing that this is an issue. I think what the court is looking at here is does discretion live there at all?
Right, because the district court said no, right? The district court ruled there is zero discretion.
No discretion. So the court can't touch this number, period, end of story. And again, that's kind of why I started with the evolution of this a little bit, is because this doesn't match. What's happening doesn't fit. It's not okay. You know, that we even if you disagree with this example and feel like Judge Hammerly abused the discretion that she does have over this situation, I do believe that magistrate courts just through this one line, just in it's well settled in Idaho law that an award or modification of a child support award is left to the sound discretion of the trial court, and we shouldn't rob them of that. Especially when it comes to even just making minor adjustments or helping people who would otherwise need it, especially people who are in situations where just a few hundred dollars matters. And a lot of times it doesn't need to be an egregious example of 15 months or 2 years. It's my ICCP was included in the child support calculation. Now I'm in front of the court 3 months late. Now I got my lawyer, and now I'm 3 months late. Now I'm in front of the court. Can the court not satisfy that or make that right? Because if it can't, I need to pull all those numbers out of child support. I should never include the child tax credit in child support. I shouldn't include it, because if it ever changes before I can get into court, or if something in their life happens that makes that factual scenario difficult, I need to be able to modify it retroactively, right?
So help me. I want you to walk through that just a little bit more basic, because I'm not tracking everything that you're saying, but I want to understand it. So tell me what your orders typically look like.
Yeah.
And tell me how you're saying that you would have to modify them.
Child support allows for 5 adjustments. It allows for the child tax credit, travel costs, health insurance, disability, and then it allows for child care. When we prepare our child support orders, we, and magistrates do this without us asking either, we fill that order with the insurance premium that's subject to change and can move around at its own whim, right? We put ICCP or we put child care costs in there, and that can move all around. And we put health insurance in there. We put all those sorts of things in there. And so if I load that number with all of these things that have to do with third parties, things totally out of my control, things totally out of the magistrate's control, the party's control. And let's say dad loses his job and insurance disappears. Should mom still pay the premiums? If it's included in the child support calculation, it's gotcha. Yes. She's going to pay those premiums. If I break it out and I take it out of the child support number, I can do whatever I want. The court maintains its discretion. I can have the court change any of those adjustments. Why would I ever put an adjustment into the child support number unless it's backed up by the magistrate's discretion to make things right if something falls out from underneath it. I just never would. And so if what you're telling me is you know, if your decision here is that we're going to go with the district court's decision here, my new best practice is to never put these adjustments, even the child tax credit, should never be included in the child support calculation itself, because if it ever changes, my clients are not, we got to race into court. We got to race in there and make sure that they don't get that gotcha moment. And we did this during, this happened. The child tax credit changed from $2,000 to $3,000. And you know what the magistrate courts did was they abated it and they satisfied it. I didn't, especially since it was a mid-year change on the child tax credit. The IRS came in and changed it like in March. Are we trying to make sure that these litigants that are coming in don't get January and February and March for some reason? You know, these are the situations where we can't have it both ways on the child support calculation number. Either we're going to include the adjustments and the court's going to maintain its discretion, or I need to rip it apart and I need to make sure that I'm not exposing my clients to this sort of just, no, that's behind an electric fence now. And if anything happens, we're done.
So, and if you don't have those numbers in there, if you don't plug them in and you go to your new best practice, what does that look like from an enforcement situation?
That's the problem.
Down the line?
That's the problem is the pro of having it in the child support number was my income withholding order, where I can garnish the wages for not just child support, but for my child care costs and my insurance and all of those sort of things. That's the problem. That's the upside.
So then you're having every time, if you've got an enforcement problem, then you've got to go in and you've got to prove what those numbers are. And basically you're into the whole, now at least we've got the new flexible rule where you can try to enforce the support order informally, not through contempt, blah, blah, blah. But now you're having to prove those numbers.
I'm having to go, now if I break them all out, I can't use an income withholding order like I can with child support. You know, I'm going to have to privately sue them for the past due child or health insurance premiums, and I'm going to have to go through that route. So my point is, if we're going to break it all out, I'm looking at my client and saying enforcement is going to be tough.
Well, and honestly, I question whether breaking it all out puts you in any better position. Because I think there's an argument that even if you break those other things out, there's still support.
You could, and that would be a question for you, I guess. I don't believe that would be child support in that situation. It would be something else, but I've never practiced that way. But what I know is that magistrate courts would fix that. You know, magistrate courts don't have you pay things you don't owe. And so what's happening right here is we're putting magistrate courts in a position where people are having to pay things they don't owe, or they're paying twice, or they're not paying at all. And so we can't do a whole cloth rip apart of the magistrate's discretion on this situation. It's just going to kill us. As practitioners, it's not adding a tool to our toolbox. It's taking one out.
And I understand, and I'm sympathetic to the argument. I'm just struggling with how going the route you're asking us to go doesn't ignore 32709. That's my struggle.
And I think it's and I know what you're saying, and I think it's as simple as I don't believe that every time you touch that number, it's a modification.
You know, it's interesting. We had a case yesterday that, of course, you didn't get to watch, in which we discussed the power of the word only and whether something says if versus only if, what a big difference that is. In this case, is there any way to work around the word only and somehow find discretion there? Plain meaning of the statute.
And again, this is my argument fundamentally, is that this situation doesn't draw up 32709 because it's not a modification.
It's a satisfaction.
It's a satisfaction. But even if we're looking in and that's what I mean is, if I'm going in and I'm modifying child support, and I And again, this is why the world of family law is important to kind of look at, is if I'm modifying child support, it's different, it's completely different, at least to me, than going in and asking Judge Hammerly to satisfy something that's already been paid.
The district court looked at it as a de facto modification.
Absolutely. And that this was a convenient workaround.
Right.
And so then what? Sorry, go ahead.
Do those distinctions, the difference between a de facto modification or a convenient workaround, is there a functional difference between that?
I believe so. I don't believe that. I never asked Judge Hammerly to change the child support number, ever. And she never made a decision. In her decision, she never said, I'm modifying the child support number. She's saying, I can see over here that this was already paid. And if I give it to you again, you're going to get it twice. It's clear in the Idaho child support guidelines that Idaho favors the idea that you would pay, that you would get this offset. And so
offsets a lot in other areas of the law. Certain jury verdicts are subject to offsets.
Yep.
A bunch of different factors can offset that. Is this a? Can you cite any examples in family law, based on your expertise as the family law practitioner, where we allow these kind of offsets routinely?
Well,
other than this category,
one of the credits, and I'm not going to know the exact statute, but it's if you have the kids more than 14 days and you have primary custody, there's a credit there for you, right? Does it fly in the face of 32709? When the child support guidelines were created, was that in conflict? You know, because it's definitely below the 120 days. And so there's a carve out in the child support guidelines that if we take the district court's interpretation is already violating it. Because I can go into court and I can say, I have another opportunity to ask for a credit in a shortened amount of time frame over the 120-day mark. It's why I never really use the 120-day exception. I have an exception way more narrow in the child support guidelines itself that really covers this topic for the most part.
And I never had the opportunity to practice under the new child support guidelines. When I did family law, it seems like we were always going back to court, always formally bringing hostile motions against each other. So your position is this is just part of the evolution that the new family law rules have introduced?
My argument is certainly it doesn't fit, and that this body is in charge of the Idaho Child Support Guidelines, and I think that we need to look at them with fresh eyes and decide how we want this to go, because in the evolution of family law and in the evolution of how we're treating litigants in court, this doesn't fit. This is a situation in which, no, the court does need to keep its discretion. The court does need to, at least, even if you disagree with Judge Hammerly's decision, which is fine, we need to agree that there's some discretion there to look at unjust results that happened during that time frame, during that time period, make sure that we can do something about it. Because I don't know why we're handcuffing our magistrate courts during that time frame. It makes no sense, and it's not good for people who show up just a couple of months late to say, hey, I'm out $600 on my health insurance premiums because they were never paid. Idaho law thinks you should take it in the shorts.
So, Mr. Nielsen, can I shift a little bit to 32709 sub 2 and the argument that because the statute sets forth one credit for arrearages and only one credit for arrearages, that's an indication that that's the only credit that's allowed for arrearages.
And again, this is where it looks like I'm trying to run around the statute. But that's it. But I'm just saying, I think this is. Discretion lives here. And this is what I argued in my briefing, was that if we're going to allow the courts to have this much discretion, it's just going to fill the whole space, just kind of like in a physical science textbook where the gas chamber, it just fills any space unoccupied. And then look at a statute and say, no, 32709 completely eviscerates that. It totally gobbles it up. There is no other way around it. And I just don't think that that's, I don't think that that one exception is even implicated in this case at all, because I think we're looking completely separate from it.
I have a question for you going back to the concept of set-offs, credits, satisfaction. I just want to change the hypothetical a bit. If there were a child support arrearage, your client, for example, hadn't been paying for, say, 6 months, and a lump sum payment came in to your client as the representative payee of the kids, could he use that to satisfy that arrearage?
Yes, I think so. You're saying if he's the one, if he was a representative payee, he owes her money, he got that amount. Yes, absolutely. And I think he should.
All rise, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Iowa.
Thank you. Be seated, please. We're told that the recording is now back online, or you're back on record in case 51274. And Mr. Adams, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Your Honors. Mr. Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court, I would prefer to start with questions. I know that sometimes I need to talk a little to shake some questions loose, but at this point, I don't think the facts are highly in dispute in this case, or even disputed at all. And so, unless the court has questions, I can launch into a discussion, but I would start there.
I have one.
Yes.
Can you speak up just a tad?
I will do my best.
Thank you.
I'll just note from the magistrate's question. Talk about that for a minute. Certainly there's the four-pronged Lonneborg test that includes as one of the prongs acting within the appropriate parameters of the law. The statute's pretty clear on its face here. How does that fit within this notion of the ability of magistrates to see the forest from the trees and deal with these issues, avoiding running to the courthouse all the time? Let's talk about that.
Well, Chief Justice Bevin, I believe that the magistrates have a lot of discretion, but there's no such thing in any case as unlimited discretion. No judge has discretion to do whatever they want under any circumstances. As the court pointed out, the third prong of the Lonneborg test is that the trial court acts within the bounds of the law. And to act within the bounds of the law, we have to look at what the law is. The law comes, of course, in this situation from numerous places. The child support guidelines, which allow the magistrate to take a lot of discretion in setting what child support is. Cases from this court, and then the statutes. In this case, we have a statute that places discretion on magistrate or on our state's magistrates in certain circumstances. The 32709 only acts in a very limited set of circumstances. And that's a situation where a decree has already been put in place. We have a situation in this case, as the court is aware, where a decree was put in place. The decree had very, very specific language as to how much was to be paid for child support and how it was to be paid and where it was to be paid. 32709 indicates that if we're going to modify the decree, meaning that we're changing how it's to be paid, the amount it's to be paid, where it's to be paid, then moving forward from the motion, the court has that discretion to make changes. But before the motion itself, the magistrate does not have that discretion. So I would suggest that under the Lonneborg standard, that the bounds of the law prohibit a magistrate or the trial court, whatever the case may be, from changing the original divorce decree, child support decree, in any way that would be considered a modification. Now, that gets us into definitions, but I think the word modification is sufficiently simple to be understood as any variance from what the decree originally said. In this case, Dan had an obligation under the decree to pay $639 and some cents a month, and to pay it to the Department of Health and Welfare on behalf of Kristen, and for a period of time that did not happen. For the...
To say, would it be fair to look at a modification as something that happens proactively and an offset as something that happens retroactively?
Well, if we... I have two answers to that. As the court knows, I have a hard time stopping talking. First, a modification would be a change to what the order said. And the order said payments should be made monthly to the Department of Health and Welfare. If the modification is that he doesn't have to pay in the future, I agree with you completely. As to moving backward in the past, what the court is doing is saying I'm changing that order because the order already had in place the requirement that he make a payment, and the payment wasn't made.
Example of a jury verdict that has offsets applied to that. That's not a modification of the jury verdict. It's an offset. And I think that's kind of the view that appellant's taking here, is that the things that are adjusting things in the past aren't modifying the order retroactively. They're just creating an offset, and then the modification is a proactive decision that moves forward.
Well, that was my second answer. In this case, we have, there's a big difference, I think, between a civil case where you have a jury verdict with an offset. Offsets in that situation are factual, depends on amounts that have been paid or whatever the situation is that gives rise to an offset.
In this, often equitable situations, right?
I think they can be, but as the court is aware, equity steps in where the law doesn't have a statement or an application. In this case, the law does have an application, but the difference is that offsets in this circumstance are based on relieving somebody of a duty that they already have to pay under an order. I propose that that is not the same thing as an offset in other situations. I don't think that you can compare the two quite equally, because what you have in a jury case is most often just an award. In this case, we have already, the order from the court is already in place. And so the question is, if one parent misses a payment, does the court have the right to relieve that person of a payment before a motion to modify is made? Under 32709, I apologize.
Sorry, I want to back up and ask whether a payment was ever missed at all.
In this case?
Yes, because as I understand it, for the months he didn't pay, every one of those months, there was a payment from Social Security to the children. Were there any months where he didn't pay and Social Security did not send a payment to the mother for the children?
To answer that specific question, I do not believe so. But to answer the question from the perspective of the facts, I apologize, Your Honor. I don't have this memorized. But the decree itself, and this is on page 317. Oh, excuse me. I'm on the wrong one. Here we go. I'm going to get there. Page 109 of the record. The decree is not that money goes to Kristen. The decree is that payments be made to the Department of Health and Welfare.
And who is Social Security making those payments on behalf of? Whose Social Security account are they making those payments from?
The three children, Your Honor. The
three children's Social Security accounts or from Mr. Gerhardt's account, and they're being paid to mother for the benefit of the children?
In this case, the case law that I'm aware of with regard to Social Security is that Social Security is an earned benefit, but In this case, the disability, while it belongs to Mr. Gerhardt had the disability, the payments were being made to and on behalf of the children. There was a separate application for each of the three children.
But my point is, it's being paid on Mr. Gerhardt's behalf, isn't it? He's the one who had to establish he was disabled before Social Security would pay a benefit to his children from his account, from his benefits, right?
That is correct. I cannot dispute that.
And so let me ask a hypothetical here. Mr. Nielsen posed it earlier. If we were in a different situation and say Mr. Gerhardt says to his mother, I can't make my child support payment this month. Can you send her a check for me? And the check comes from his mother, and it's the amount of his child support. Is your contention he has not made his child support payment that month?
That would be clearly a different set of circumstances from this case.
I'm not convinced it's that different.
Well, Your Honor, in this case, Mr. Gerhardt applied for the benefit on behalf of his children and on behalf of himself. This was an issue that could have been raised with the court. And I
want to back up to the hypothetical. If his mother makes the payment and it's her check and it's written out to mother and it's here's the amount of child support, has he made his payment that month?
For purposes of satisfying, I would feel silly making the argument that that payment has not been made. I'll be frank with the court. I could make a very formalistic legal argument that no, it has not been paid because he didn't pay it. I don't think I would be successful. I'll admit that to the court. I think I would have a hard time convincing a court that the money coming in to the Department of Health and Welfare on his behalf from another source would not be available, would not be a payment of child support. Like I said, I could say that the decree has not been complied with. That would be a very formalistic argument, and I would not be happy with myself if I made it.
And so these benefits are paid by Social Security because he has established he cannot work. And so when they're making those payments to the children, why is that not the same as having any other entity make a payment on his behalf?
Your Honor, that is a difficult question, because how does the Department of Health and Welfare understand these other payments if, as our system sets forward, the payments are being made to the Department of Health and Welfare? How are they supposed to guard this process? How are they supposed to be involved? Are we in a situation where if a grandparent makes a payment to a child for a birthday gift or for some other reason?
But that's not what we're talking about, Mr. Adams. I'm talking about payments specifically being made for the support of the children.
And I understand that. What I'm saying is I don't think it's too far afield from other money coming into the child. For example, under Idaho Code 32-1007, parents are entitled to the payments or earnings of their children. If one of the children gets a job, I realize this is a bit of a strange hypothetical. I'm not going to deny that. But the point is that where would we draw the line, or how would we draw the line as to which money coming in to the children counts as payments for and on behalf of the, I don't want to use the word non-paying parent, but it creates a very difficult situation where we have a hard time drawing a line and knowing what payments would be used as an offset. So
are you arguing that the Social Security payments were not intended to provide support for the children?
No, I'm not making that argument at all. I don't think I could make that argument in good faith, Your Honor. But what I am saying is we have an order in place that requires payments to be made to the Department of Health and Welfare. That I don't think is disputed. And what is being proposed is that alternate payments be used to satisfy that obligation, which is not a provision that's included in the decree itself.
But I like that word satisfaction because it seems to me that maybe that's the correct legal box to put all of this in, that the magistrate court is entering an order of satisfaction of an obligation under the decree, right? I mean, isn't that what's happening?
Your Honor, if we are dealing with a situation like that, I would put forward to the court that satisfactions or offsets or credits, whatever word we use.
I think offsets, credits, those and satisfaction, those are different concepts. I want to talk about satisfaction of, for example, I mean, you're in the civil world, you know what a judgment looks like. When somebody makes a partial payment, the court enters an order of partial satisfaction of judgment.
That's actually not the rule under the rules of civil procedure. I found this out once. You can only enter an order of satisfaction for complete payment. But I get the point that you're making, which is if this is a satisfaction, once again, a satisfaction falls under the rubric of a modification. A satisfaction that's the position I'm going to be taking. A satisfaction or the other two terms that we've been using, offset or
Credit,
whatever we want to call it. I think they're all the wrong kind of term to be using, because what we're looking at is a statutory interpretation question of the term modification. The modification, or the order itself says, Mr. Gearhart shall pay to the Department of Health and Welfare. The court is aware of this. So can other sources satisfy that obligation? We don't have a specific judgment for each of the entered amounts. Now, if there was a potential, as there could have been in this case, for additional payments to come in from alternate sources, it's not impossible for the magistrate to have included in the order, in the decree itself, consideration of those alternate sources. Now, perhaps that's asking a lot of the magistrates to anticipate everything, but we're not asking them to anticipate every potential payment, particularly in this case, where, as counsel has pointed out in the briefing, that the magistrate was aware there was a disability, and at the time that the decree was entered, there was no disability payments being made. At least, I don't believe that the timing worked out that way, but it was potentially there. So, could we have a situation that satisfies both 32709 and the potential equitable issues or even the legal issues? It's all it's asking is that magistrates look at this and see what issues may pop up and create an order that may take into consideration those future payments. We already have a situation where this automatically happens. For example, the decree itself says when the children turn 18, things shut off. Well, it's not too far a step to ask magistrates to include in their orders things that are likely to pop up. Now, granted.
So the magistrate court could put in its order if Social Security benefits are approved for the disabled parent and payments begin on behalf of the children, that those payments are credited against the disabled parents' support obligation.
It seems like a weird situation to ask the magistrates to predict the future, but in this circumstance, in this particular case, I don't think it's too far afield, because we ask them to predict the future all the time. And that's what their discretion is. They have discretion to craft these broad child support orders. And what their discretion does not include is to go back and relieve something that somebody did not bring up at the time that I wouldn't even want to say in this case whether it could or could not have been addressed. But it was something that was in the offing. And so this was, oh, go ahead, Your Honor.
I interrupted you. Finish your thought, and then I have a question.
I was just going to drone on, please.
Okay. So then the effect of that would be if the magistrate can't go back and satisfy, then we have a situation here where from sometime in the fall to about May, we have that lump sum payment. At the same time, Mr. Gearhart was
paying the $680 in child support than another 2 years where the kids were getting, her mom on behalf of the kids was getting the $1,275 that went up to $13-something. And if the magistrate can't go back and satisfy that, then the payment effectively is three times what was ordered. So how is that equitable?
Mathematically, in this case, there is some there, that could be created that way. What we have to do is deal with the law first and then equity second. I'm not saying that there is no equities that could apply here. What I'm saying is that these equities run up against the statute. So
it runs up against the statute if that satisfaction is considered a modification.
Well, no satisfaction, credit, offset, whatever you want to call it, exists in a vacuum. These are things that have to be brought to the court anyway. If somebody wants a satisfaction, that is something that the court, and I'm using this from the court's hypothetical, the magistrate would have to have this issue in front of them. What 32709 does is it imposes that if this issue is already in front of the court, do it early and just make a modification motion. If you do it early and make a modification motion, the issue of satisfaction, as it were, evaporates, and the issue is resolved through a modification motion.
He's always behind. I mean, it seems to me that a person in the appellant's position, if the only way that he can deal with this is to seek a modification is, he's always behind. He's always out at least 2-3 payments by the time that he gets a modification order entered.
The order itself can go back to the date of the motion. In this particular case, when the decision was made to stop paying, at that point a modification could have been filed. It was not. In order for the court to make a decision as to the offset or... I think these are the wrong terms. The magistrate doesn't deal in terms of credits or offsets or satisfactions. At least I don't see those words in 32709 or in the child support guidelines. What it does is it requires the judge, the magistrate, to just reevaluate if the circumstances are appropriate for a reevaluation, the amount that's owed. And the court does that the same way it did originally, by looking at the child support guidelines, by looking at the statute. If a modification is requested early, the motion can be filed at any time, and that can avoid any behind payments. Because we're not arguing, I mean, this court has dealt with this statute very recently twice, and though the cases that the court addressed were not on this issue, the point to be made from those cases is that we do get to go back to the date of the motion. Let's bring our motions early. Equity does not require us to sit on our rights. Actually, it encourages us to avoid sitting on our rights. Since the court would have to do the whatever calculus it would be required of it to do the offset, the credit, the satisfaction, do it as a motion. This court has said so many times that we'll treat a motion based on its substance, not on its name. So if the magistrate could potentially have the authority to say, well, I see this motion for contempt, I see this motion for enforcement, I see this other, but aren't we really dealing with a modification here? And potentially...
But why is every time that the magistrate court is dealing with a math problem, which it seems to me that that's what this is a math problem, that somehow that's a modification of the support order.
It's not.
And magistrate courts do this all the time, and we get into disputes about whether an obligation has been satisfied or not. And sometimes courts have to put pen to paper and do the math, and put calculations into spreadsheets, et cetera, to figure out how much money is owed?
Well, I'm going to try not to be glib in this answer, but just because magistrates do it all the time doesn't mean that they are correctly applying the law. Now, I agree with you. Not every mathematical issue is going to be a modification. But take a look at the Reed case. The Reed case is a very interesting example of this situation, where the father claimed that the court did not look at a particular tax credit or offset. I'm not exactly sure what it was. But it was an original decree and then followed by a motion to amend the judgment. Well, a motion to amend the judgment to reconsider the information that the person claimed was incorrect the first time, that's very, very similar, and it could apply as a motion to modify, because in that case, he was effectively saying, you didn't look at this information, you should modify it based on this, but I'm going to call it a motion to modify the judgment. So, yes, I agree with you, not every situation is going to be a motion for modification. There is one thing I did want to point out, which is that the Reed case doesn't actually say, it is well settled that the award or modification of an award of child support is left to the sound discretion of the trial court. Neither Reed nor Levin say that, or Levin, I'm not sure how it's pronounced. That is actually Judge Hammerly's reading of those cases. Those cases say that the trial court has substantial discretion in determining how much child support is awarded and how that works. But they don't actually go so far as to say unlimited discretion for modifications. What we're dealing with is, in this case, a very simple statute. I would propose it's not a statute that requires any interpretation because we're dealing with plain and simple words.
Well, here's the direct quote from Levin. As cited in the appellant's brief, it is well settled in Idaho that the award or modification of an award of child support is left to the sound discretion of the trial court.
That's in their brief, but that's not in Reed.
No, they're quoting Levin, and then they say see Levin, see Reed. I assume they're quoting Levin since it's the first cite there.
I'll go back and check it. If I'm misleading the court, I apologize. I saw it as a cite to Reed later on in the briefing because I thought, well, I need to address that if that's an issue in this case, and I went and I didn't find that quote to Reed. If it's in Levin, then the point still is all discretion is bound by law. In this case, we have a statute that says you don't get to go back before the date of the motion. And a modification, we would have to ignore the plain meaning of the word modification to get around this, is my position. Finally, Your Honors, I think in this case, Kristen has the right to rely on the original order from Judge Hammerly. We're dealing with an order that says what it says. And the only way to avoid that order would be to modify it. That's what I'm proposing before the court, is that maybe this is a case-specific situation. Maybe we're dealing with a situation that will affect all magistrate judges in Idaho. But if the law says what it says, and a satisfaction or a credit or an offset, however it's styled, I think those are all the wrong terms, applied, it's a modification, which is not permitted under the statute. Once again, it's just encouraged people to move quickly. And since these issues are already before the court anyway, why not include the motion for modification?
Okay, I want to clarify something maybe I said was potentially misleading. Actually, I believe the appellant's brief is quoting from Judge Hammerly's decision. She cited to Levin and Reed, and he cites to Levin and Reed. I don't have Levin in front of me, so this is Judge Hammerly's take.
I agree. That is my understanding of how Judge Hammerly reads Levin and Reed. That quote itself, I did not find in Reed, and I will admit I did not look in Levin. Unless the court has more questions, I would briefly talk about attorney fees, but I think the court understands my position on attorney fees. we're solely seeking them related to this appeal. And there is, under 12.121, if the court determines that this is a straightforward statute, then, and it applies in this case, there is more than substantial case law that says that improper or, I believe the word imprudent readings or unavailable readings, I'm not exactly sure what the language was, but if the statute is unambiguous and an alternate untenable proposition is made, then the case is frivolous.
What's untenable about the appeal here today?
In this case, I propose that the statute is unambiguous. The statute does say what it says. We might have to alter how we do things in Idaho. The magistrates may have to alter how they do things. Or we go to the legislature and say, legislature, this is not, this is what's being done and it needs to be fixed. Either of those is possible, but it does not justify the argument that we can ignore the statute. And that's what I propose is the only way we can get to, as the court has discussed, the many different words to work around what is a modification. Obviously, well, I'm out of time, Your Honor. Do you want me to finish answering that question?
You're welcome to.
Okay. Very shortly, this is a statutory interpretation question. And statutory interpretation questions, if the statute is clear and unambiguous, the only way to avoid it is to ignore it. And that's not a tenable proposition for how to interpret a statute. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, sir. Counsel, thank you both. We appreciate your argument today, standing our fits and starts. The matter is now under advisement, and we will render a decision in due course. We'll be in recess for approximately 10 minutes.
All rise, please.